Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. When Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro announced results of a grand jury report on sex abuse in the Catholic Church last month, this was the sentence that shocked the most people.
Over a 10-year period, the priest, Gus Giella, sexually abused five sisters from the same family. The family of nine siblings was very involved with the church. Giella met his victims when the girls came to the rectory to help count collections. Giella began sexually abusing one of the sisters, Carolyn, when she was just 18 months old. His abuse continued until she was 12.
The Fortney sisters were sexually assaulted, abused, and molested by one priest, Reverend Augustine Giella, over a period of years. Giella was arrested for sexual misconduct involving another girl, but died before going to trial in 1992. Four of the five Fortney sisters are with us today, along with Pennsylvania's victim advocate Jennifer Storm, joining us Carolyn, Laura, Patty, and Teresa Fortney. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Hi. Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send us an email, smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. I want to thank you for coming on the program because this does take a lot of courage. And, you know, we'll be talking about why you're speaking out in just a few minutes. But first of all, tell me about your family, the Fortney family, nine siblings. Tell us about the Fortneys.
Well, like you said, nine siblings, two amazing parents. We grew up in Enhot, Pennsylvania. And small town, and we were just a very close family. A lot of craziness, a lot of fun. And we grew up very devout Catholic and went to a small church in Enhot and Bishop Newman Catholic School there.
So you did go to Catholic school?
We did, yes, we all did.
In high school, did you go to Bishop McDevitt? Or
some of us did. I know I went for a day just to try it out, and then I wanted to go to public school. And my sister, I think it was Margie, right, mm-hmm. that went to Bishop McDevitt, but then the most of us went to public school after eighth grade. Mm.
So what were your childhoods like?
Free-spirited.
I can tell that already.
Busy.
Playing in the mud, running around.
Yeah, busy.
We lived back in.
Yeah. There was a lot of laundry, I remember.
I would imagine.
My brother, we always had to hide the food from him because he would eat all this cereal. It was fun. It was a great childhood. I'll never forget, you know. For me, Christmas was a great day because it was the room was filled with wrapping paper. I mean, we were swimming in it. And I just remember, you know, growing up, you know, earlier in my early years, just loving to have such a big family, mm-hmm. but also wanting to stand out in some way too, because there were so many of us.
How did you do that?
Well, I kind of failed at that because I would come home and I would pretend like I was hiding, I would hide. Until somebody would find me, and I'd usually fall asleep in my hiding place.
So somebody would have to wake her up.
My memories of when we were younger is our big kitchen table. We didn't have chairs. We had benches because it was just easier. So, and our dad made that table. And he also made two chairs, one for my mom and one for my dad, and we always called it the king's chair and the queen's chair.
Yeah.
So you had mentioned that you were a religious family. Would you call yourselves devout Catholics?
Absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
we were.
So when you say devout Catholic, what does that mean?
It was a community of Catholics. I mean, we lived our life on a daily basis that revolved around being Catholic. We went to Catholic school. Our parents made sure that we were at church every Sunday. Our friends were Catholics. Our family's friends were Catholics. It was just our life.
Yeah. All the sacraments.
Yeah.
And both of our parents were raised in Catholic orphanages.
Right.
They were Catholic, you know, went to Catholic church and school 365 days of the year. So,
yeah, it's just all we knew.
Yeah.
So obviously the church was very important to you, and I would imagine your relationship with God.
Oh, it was absolutely. Everything.
It was everything. Mm-hmm. All right, so, you know, as you're describing your childhood and you're laughing and you're joking, there may be people out there who have heard your story and heard what the Attorney General had to say and think, oh, how could they laugh? How could they joke now? And how could they talk about having a happy childhood? Before we get into that, tell me about Father Augustine Jello. How would you describe him? And, you know, obviously we're going to talk about his crimes in just a few minutes, but how would you describe him?
Well, this is Laura. I was in fifth grade, and I actually am the one who met him first. And, you know, our grandfather passed away a few months before he came to our parish. And when he walked into my fifth grade classroom, he reminded me of our grandfather, even looking like him.
Yeah.
And so immediately I was drawn to him. And so, you know, he asked for volunteers in the classroom, and I quickly raised my hand, being the people-pleaser child that I was, wanting to stand out in the family. And so he had me start doing odd jobs around the rectory. And, you know, early on, I mean, he really gained my trust. He did all the right things. He filled that grandfatherly role. He you know, gave us treats. Mm-hmm. He was just a warm person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember, you know, him coming, you know, looking in the window at my class and having this special wave. It was like a special sign just for me. And then on the playground, he would always have his pockets full of Tootsie Rolls, and he always made sure I knew that he gave me more. So it's just, you know, he gained my trust. Mm-hmm. And early on, it was a great relationship. It wasn't until, and even, you know, you asked the question about, you know, as a child, I was 10 at the time. So, you know, my earlier years as a child were very happy and just exciting with the family. It wasn't until we met him, and I can't even remember the exact timing of it for me. I just eventually remember feeling uncomfortable in his space. That's the only way I could really put it. It's something that, you know, with grooming, it happens over time. He was very smart about it, because he spent a lot of time gaining trust.
Yeah.
So that when he was doing things like pull in your bra strap and those different things that early on, type of things that were grooming you, you kind of just brushed it off because,
when I first met him, I just remember him being funny, and he was a cool priest.
Yeah.
He was... he had the best stories. He would tell us stories of, you know, being out on his priestly duties, of giving last rites at accident scenes, and how he would handle different problems in different churches. And he was fun to be around. Mm-hmm. A lot of fun. Mm-hmm.
Jennifer, we've talked about grooming over the years.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear Lard describe what the Father... And I'm not going to call him Father. What Jella did is that almost classic grooming?
100%. It's how these predators engage their communities. It's how they engage the families around the victims they target. You know, first and foremost, they gain trust, and they want to be likable, and they want to be trustworthy, because that's how they access the individuals that they're trying to harm. And that's how they get away with it. Because it's confusing to have these, you know, you're going to hear about the opposite feelings that they have in a moment. And it's really hard to reconcile those. And it's very real. You know, you meet this person, you have these initial reactions, and you have this relationship. And then all of a sudden, this slow violation starts to come about, and it's incredibly confusing. It's confusing for adults. Imagine what it's like for a 10-year-old child.
Go ahead, Karen.
So for us, you know, sexually we were abused, and so we were groomed to for him to be able to sexually abuse us. But if you think about it, the world has also been groomed by the Catholic Church spiritually. You know, everybody trusts them. Nobody ever thought, you know, this kind of stuff happened. And so it's just, when you think about grooming, you know, it's all those mm-hmm. times when you see the Pope coming into town and everybody's, you know, wanting their baby to get touched by the Pope. I mean.
So what's your, that trust that you had, I mean, you're young, you're mm-hmm. a child. I mean, this is, must be confusing to begin with, but especially confusing when it's someone who has been in your home that has been revered. Oh, I know Catholic families revere their priest,
yeah.
And it's different. So that trust must have created those even more feelings of confusion, did it?
Absolutely. It's definitely different. It's like Carolyn said, you know, it's when you are culturally conditioned, and we were conditioned by the culture of the Catholic Church to believe that the priest was the mediator between God and man, and we believed that the Pope was infallible. We were taught that. We believed that when the priest talked, that it was God talking. I mean, that's what we believed, that what he said was the next best thing to God talking. And so I can remember, you know, my dad saying, you know, listen to his teachings, and my mom, it being important for them, for us to be in his presence, because it was, we were in the presence of God, and it was supposed to make us better.
Mm-hmm. How old were you when the abuse started?
13.
13, mm-hmm. Carolyn?
I was around 2.
Around 2.
Mm-hmm.
Laura?
10.
Mm-hmm.
I was in first grade.
First grade. Carolyn, I got to follow up with you. I had seen reports that about 18 months old to 2 years old. How did you know that it had occurred? I mean, obviously, most people don't remember. No one remembers when they were 18 months old. How did you find out?
No, you're right. People don't remember that young. But I was about 2.5 to 3 years ago is when our family started talking about this. And, you know, we started having conversations with our parents about when he, when I first met him. And so, you know, based on the evidence from the investigation that they did in his, I think it's like in his confessional, or confessional.
His deposition.
Yeah, his deposition. Mm-hmm. He states in there when he met me. And then through all the pictures and stuff like that, it's just, it's all right there.
So there were nude photos.
There were nude photos mm-hmm. of Carolyn. How old were the photos? I mean.
Well, when I looked back through the case report, I mean, that's how they helped to determine how old she was through the pictures. He had a complete picture record of her.
So when he was arrested and he died before going to trial, he did confess? He did?
Yes, he did.
Yep.
Okay. There's so much more we want to talk about with the 40 sisters. And by the way, several are married. Are all you married? No? Okay, so we're only using maiden name with Fortney. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, Carolyn, Laura, Patty, and Teresa Fortney, that's their maiden names, and Pennsylvania victim advocate Jennifer Storm. We're talking about the report that came out last month from Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro that five members of one family, the Fortney family, who were abused, molested, assaulted by one priest, Augustine Gilla, who has since died, no longer on this earth. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, you can leave a tweet at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, now, I said to you ahead of time, talk about what you want If there's something you don't want to talk about, just say so. And I don't want to be graphic for the sense of being graphic here, but what kind of abuse are we talking about without getting too graphic? I'm sure you don't want to get too graphic, but what kind of abuse are we talking about at the hands of Jell-O?
I can start with that. This is Patty. I was 13 when it started, and I believe that he used me more to groom the younger ones. So the things that he did to me were to groom them. And then there was a second side of him that he was obsessed with the human form and reproduction and the way the body worked. So he used me for that also. And what I mean by that is when he would use me sexually to groom them, it was in the form of making sure he would hug me, kiss me in front of them, talk about my breast size, that my bra needed to be a certain size, or my breasts would get saggy as I got older, things like that. And then the other side to him, where he was obsessed with reproduction and the body, is when he would come into the bathroom on me. And he was obsessed with the menstrual cycle. He needed to know when you were menstruating. He needed to see that. He collected the waste from that. He asked me to cut pubic hairs off for him. He kept them in petri dishes. We later found out because they were in the evidence that was gathered from his home. And those types of things.
Same thing or tip similar things?
This is Laura. For me, I'm still figuring all of that out. I know how I was groomed. About 2.5 years ago, when Carolyn stepped up and wanted to break the silence for all of us, Patty would call me and say, "Laura, do you remember when?" And I'm like, "No, but now I do." And I kind of got to the point with Patty. I said, "You know, can you just let me figure it out for myself?" And so, you know, every day there's a trigger that triggers a new thought. But one of the most recent things for me is I remember unpacking his boxes. That was one of my jobs from his move, and it was in the second floor, and his bedroom was across the way. And I remember him being just in his underwear, his, you know, little underwear, and coming towards me. And I just remember being very panicked and scared. And I quick locked the door. And after that point, I don't know what happened. I don't remember anything after that. I just remember locking the door and being afraid because he was coming towards me. And so I'm still figuring all of that out.
But Laura, you said that, you know, growing up, he was your favorite priest.
Yeah.
When did it change? When did you realize what he was doing was not right and that you didn't feel drawn to him, that you felt very uncomfortable?
That's what's so confusing for me, because I remember even when this all came out about Carolyn, I just felt so sorry for him in a way, because it was like he was two people to me. He was this friend that I grew to trust, but then this man, and I didn't even think about myself too much then. I thought more of Carolyn. Actually, I thought more about my parents, how broken they were. Our family was just, at that point, the word for me is numb. I remember just looking at everybody, and Patty was getting married a week before this, or a couple weeks before, I don't know exactly when, but I just remember that everybody was just walking around like zombies almost. It was weird.
So the four of you, and there, you had another sister who's not here today, but the four of you, you didn't talk about this amongst yourself?
That's what I know. No. That's hard to believe. That's what people.
No, I don't know. Yeah. Jennifer, I don't think it is hard to believe, is it? I
mean, no, it's completely common that people, especially in a family unit that are experiencing this, are not going to speak to one another about it. There's an incredible amount of shame and guilt and disbelief. You know, as Laura is talking about, you're still putting those pieces together as you get older and as your brain starts to allow you to remember these really horrific suppressed things. So what they're experiencing is completely normal and common. You know, you're having these very normal reactions to these really abnormal things that have happened to you.
Plus, we were gagged. There was a gag order.
Right, right. And you did have two settlements with the diocese,
right.
And you had signed a non-disclosure, correct?
Or I never signed anything. I mean...
Your parents?
My parents did, yeah. Okay. I was an adult, but...
I was just going to just add on to that. We were raised not to talk about things like that, you know? It was... I don't want to say that it was shameful for us to talk about. I think it was more of a... modest, yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. It was a modest thing for us. Not, I mean, and to say that to our parents or to bring it up to our parents, it was just a more of an embarrassing thing. Like you didn't want to talk like that to them, you know.
So, Carolyn, were you the first to talk about this?
So about 2.5 years ago, I was watching the Oscars, which I never do, and that year, Spotlight, the movie, was the movie of the year, and I just remember sitting there, and they played the trailer, and I just broke down.
Spotlight about abuse in the Catholic Church, and I think it was it just boys in that case?
I can't remember.
I don't know.
It was almost all boys, but yeah.
So when you saw this, I mean, this had occurred. Jell-O died in 1992, so it's been over 20 years. So in 2015, 2016 is when you saw that and realized you wanted to speak out?
Yeah, it was. I feel like I had just had enough. I didn't feel like I had a purpose in life. I just felt like I needed to do something to help other people and make that my purpose and my driving force.
Did you suspect, have any inkling that your sisters have been abused as well?
No.
So how did this conversation all come about?
Well, Laura and Patty noticed that I was going downhill that week. It was, I think, February 29th of 2015. That was a Sunday. 2 days later, the grand jury report of Altoona Johnstown dropped, and I fell apart. Yeah. And they noticed it, and we started talking about it. It was like the first time ever. Right. None of us knew really about Teresa. And then these two are just realizing their own abuse as well, so.
I mean, what a shock, though. You probably all thought it was just you.
Right.
And then to find out that your sisters, the people you were so close with, had suffered the same thing. I mean, that's incredible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very lonely.
Yeah.
It was incredible. And one of the things that I'd like to touch back on is the grooming. For me, the grooming was critical. And in my... not even realizing that it was sexual abuse. So I realized that here I am, an adult woman, and I didn't even think back to those times, you know, where he was collecting menstrual and the things he did in the bathroom. And he was a master manipulator, and he was a genius groomer. He groomed my family and groomed us to actually believe he was like, the things he was doing were, you know, priestly duties. So for me, I would think of him, I knew I was uncomfortable when he would come into the bathroom, very uncomfortable because, like, you know, some of my sisters said, we were a very modest family. I mean, it's just not, you just didn't go in on the bathroom with people. And so this is very uncomfortable, but he would, you know, talk to you about. He has to make sure that you're okay and things. So you think of him as like a doctor, you know. And so later in life, you know, when I was in a counseling session with my pastor and his wife, I was talking about Carolyn and the guilt that I felt. And it's just something I've carried for a long time. And my guilt was more because I was the oldest one there. I should have known. I should have taken care of my sister, you know. And but my pastor is the one who asked me questions that led to me talking about myself. And even then, I didn't even realize that I was sexually abused. And I was 40 years old or whatever. And, you know, I was probably pushing 40, if not 40. I can't remember the exact time. Mm-hmm.
So your parents, obviously, you all had a great relationship with your mm-hmm. parents. They found out. How did they find out? And how did they react? And what did they think about it?
So I got a call. I was in town for my wedding. And my mom called me and said, "Patty, Sandra just called me. She had said that one of my nieces had found a box of naked pictures of Carolyn and pornography in a box."
Child pornography.
No, it was Playboy magazines.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, the pictures of Carolyn, she was naked in them. And she, my mom said, "I need you to go and pick up Carolyn and bring her to me," because my mom was working. And so I went and picked up Carolyn, and I just pulled over on the side of the road, and I did not ask her. I just told her, you know, "We know, and this is never going to happen to you again. You know, it's not your fault," and everything. And so I took her to my mom's house, or to where my mom was working, and, you know, my mom, of course, hugged her and everything and told her same thing, you know, "We believe you. Nothing's ever going to happen to you." And my mom was devastated. I think she was in shock. And then I took Carolyn right away back to our family home where my dad was. And I remember he was sitting at the kitchen table. He was actually sitting in mom's chair. He wasn't in his chair. And Carolyn ran in the house and ran straight upstairs and hid. And I told my dad. And he stood up and he went right to the bottom of our steps and he said, "Carolyn, I want you to come down here." And she came down and she was hysterically crying, and he hugged her and he said, "I believe you." And he said, "Nothing's ever going to happen to you again. Nobody will ever hurt you again." And he believed immediately.
Did your parents feel guilty?
Absolutely.
Till this day.
Yeah.
What did they say to you that let you know that they felt like they could? I saw a clip on CBS News where your dad said that, "I wonder where I went wrong." And you know, you knew that he was guilty when he said that.
You know, my parents did all the right things. I mean, we weren't even allowed to say the word jerk. Like, I mean, they made sure we went to church every Sunday. They made sure we went to Bible school every year. They worked hard. My mom had, when it got a little tough, my mom got a job waitressing 11 to 7 graveyard shift just for lunch money, for us to have lunch money. They made sure that we were a unit as a family, that we always took care of each other and had each other's back. And they made sure that we were, you know, we had all the sacraments and we were connected to the priests and the nuns. And I mean, our parties, my parents' anniversary was at the church. I mean, everything we did was there. They my parents felt they were doing the right thing, and they were. They were doing the right things. You know, hindsight's 20/20. You can always look back and say, where did I go wrong? But, you know, for our pedophile priest, he was masterful. He was masterful. And he, you know, I feel too, he was in a profession that provided within the church that provided a safe place for him to be masterful at his
perversion.
Yeah. Jennifer, so. You know, one of the things that really sticks out to me is that their parents, mom and dad, believed what they were saying.
Yeah.
Because so often, I don't know how often, but we know that very often, especially when a priest is held in such high esteem, that parents will say, no, you must be wrong on this.
Unfortunately, it's so all too often that parents immediately dismiss or say, well, you must have taken the gestures of kindness wrong, or you must have somehow, you know, misinterpreted what the priest was doing. And what the Fortney parents did was such a gift for these kids. You know, this is truly one of the strongest families I've ever had the privilege to know. And I've known Carolyn, I think back to 2013, and I know sometimes she doubts her own strength, but I have messages from her that date back to them where she is always saying, I'm going to fight for change. I'm going to stand up for victims. So even in her weakest moments, she's been one of the strongest people I know. And I know that comes from the love and the support and the unconditionalness of her parents. I mean, to have that immediate belief, to have your first interaction be a hug and an embrace, is truly not what most victims receive. I've sat in court, unfortunately, with far too many children whose parents don't believe them to the extent that they're at the other side of the courtroom sitting with the person who offended upon them, especially if it's a family member or someone they revered or loved or trusted. So it truly, this family is unique and hopefully is a shining example to other parents that when your child says something like this to you, you believe them first. You believe them.
I have another, this is from the Attorney General Josh Shapiro's press conference last month, and has to do with something that your mom said.
The mother of the girls abused by Giella testified before the grand jury. She said she confronted church officials, Monsignor Overbaugh, when she learned of Giella's years of abusing his daughters. In response, she said the Monsignor told her, I wondered why you were letting them go to the rectory.
When you heard that, what did you think?
Well, about 2.5 years ago, we had started talking about it amongst ourselves. That was one of the things that we talked about, one of the big things with our mom, just wanting to understand it. You know, she had written a letter back to the bishop at that time, to Tillo, you know, just really angry and upset and just in dismay and disbelief that they knew and didn't say anything to her.
Well, that's kind of what I took from that, is that
they did know.
Other people knew, and it was like this priest that she talked to put it back on your family. Like, well, you sent them to the rectory.
Absolutely. And Josh Shapiro didn't say what my mom said back to him then, and my mom said, well, when my other daughters were helping you out at the rectory, should I have worried about you too? Because my older sisters helped Father Overbaugh, who was then Monsignor Overbaugh, helped at the rectory with him. Just like we did with Jella.
Yeah, and actually up until the day of the grand jury report, they revered and still loved him, Father Overbaugh, or Monsignor Overbaugh. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you could see it in Sandra's eyes how
devastated she was.
She was.
Yeah. Well, the four of you have since left the church. Why did you leave? I mean, in hindsight, we understand. But why did you leave? Well, kind of, I don't know.
It's just a constant remembrance you don't want to subject yourself to. Mm-hmm. I haven't even been in my town for years. Afraid of running into a friend or somebody that'll remind me of it.
So you go out of your way to try to not be reminded of it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Is this something you think about every day?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Every day.
Yes, definitely.
When you think about it every day, I mean, what do you think? I mean, are there things that remind you or just what?
Yeah. There's triggers everywhere. You know, you see a stained glass window. It's hard for me to go into church with a stained glass window because it reminds me. It's even hard for me to sit in the church that I'm a member of now, just even seeing a man in the pulpit. For me, I left the Catholic Church before the abuse was identified with Carolyn. I had gone to a church with my girlfriend when I was younger and slept overnight. And I remember feeling so much better in that church for some reason. Now I know it was the Holy Spirit for me. But I started to really dig into the Bible on my own and not what a man was interpreting. I counted on the Holy Spirit to reveal it to me. And one thing that just didn't sit right for me was baptism, that my kids were going to go to hell if I didn't baptize them, if I didn't do my job as a parent to baptize them. So I started to just dig in deeper. And for me, I was just led away from the Catholic Church for more of the doctrine reason, you know, the reasons of through my own search.
You all have left
the Catholic. But that contributed too, I'm sure.
You all have left the Catholic Church, but do you all still have faith?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I do. I can't speak I do. For that.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
No? Why not?
I don't know. I mean, I guess it's just, for me, it was 10 years of my childhood from when I was a baby till almost a preteen, and I guess just that amount of time being lied to about what I thought was so real and amazing and true.
Was there ever a time where the four of you said, why would God let something like this happen to him?
Every day.
I don't have faith in religion. That's for me. I have faith in the one true God, and that's what I've found the truth for me. I pray for that for my sisters, but for me, religion has really messed up a lot for people, and have caused people that I know that I've talked to or that have shared with me their turn against God, and that's a travesty for me, because now in my adult life, if I didn't have my relationship with Christ, I would be, I don't know how I would get through some days. But it's not through a man, it's not through a statue, it's not through rituals, it's not through what somebody tells me I need to believe. You know, it's through what the Holy Spirit presses upon my spirit and what comes out to me through the pages of what I believe is the truth, which is the Bible.
We're going to talk about more of this and what the 4D Sisters would like to see happen to protect other children, other people in the future in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guests today, Carolyn, Laura, Patty, and Teresa Fortney, and Pennsylvania's victim advocate, Jennifer Storm. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, you could send a tweet to us, @SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Sharon in Harrisburg. Sharon, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
I wanted to just give a shout-out of support to the Fortney sisters. I went to McDevitt class of 79, and I know a couple of the sisters. And I happened to go to a Catholic school for 16 years, grade school, high school, and college, and found out through the Attorney General's report that my parish priest at Our Lady's in Harrisburg, which is at 3rd McClay, was named in the report Father Haviland, who was the one that gave me my communion rites. Then, of course, a lot of the McDevitt people that were abused, and even, you know, the school was named after Bishop McDevitt, who might have had a part in this 70 years ago. And then fast forward to college, University of Scranton, which is a Jesuit school, and I just read where they've renamed all these buildings on campus because of culpable bishops. So, you know, for 16 years, you know, Catholic school, I'm glad I learned my morality, you know, from friends and family and community and didn't rely on the Catholic teachings.
Thank you very much for your call. And I want to say, first of all, I want to get your reaction to what Sharon had to say. I want to say that we're not here to put the Catholic Church in a, because there are very, very many people who have had positive relationships, and it's very important to them. And, you know, we're talking about 300 priests over a 70-year period. So just wanted to mention that up front in case someone tunes into this and says that we're just here to bash Catholics. But when you hear what Sharon had to say, do you know who Sharon is? She said that she... Okay. But when you hear what she had to say...
I may have an idea who okay. she is, but I'm not sure.
But what do you think?
My heart breaks for her. I've said it. We've all talked about it, how, you know, she's us, you know. She's had to learn the hard way just in reading the grand jury report and everything that a lot of what maybe she... thought was pure wasn't. And
yeah, it kind of goes back to what I said in the beginning with, you know, we were groomed. And it's like, you know, it's prime example of every Catholic and even other people, other religions being groomed by the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. She was groomed too to believe, like Patty said, it was pure and good.
Go ahead, Lauren.
My heart goes out to all Catholics because I remember how it felt to not trust anymore. And when you have something that you hold so dear, that is everything, every part of your life, and then you're just wandering around wondering, you know, I remember going into church. My aunt had passed away. And we went to St. Catherine's for her funeral. And I remember walking in there feeling like, oh my gosh, can you trust any of these people? Because once trust is broken, it's hard to get back. And that's where my heart breaks for them.
I would say to Sharon, you know, get on board with helping to clean it up. Mm-hmm. To, you know, yeah. Speak out to your representatives because... it doesn't have to be this way for the Catholic Church. Right. I believe that if, I don't care if you stay in the Catholic Church or you don't, if you stay in the Catholic Church, I would suggest not just taking everything at face value anymore, asking questions, demand for transparency, demand for your faith to be, you know, built back up brick by brick after it has been cleansed.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Agreed.
That hasn't been allowed to happen because of our arbitrary laws.
Right.
And so a big portion of what the Fortney sisters are trying to do is to help change those laws with statute of limitation reform. Because I mean, even within this report, it's not fully transparent because some, you know, for the first time in our history, we've had people named in a grand jury report able to challenge that and have their names redacted. You know, so our attorney general in his incredible, brave manner is fighting that later on this month. But also we're trying to change the law so that we can reveal those other names for those victims who don't have the ability through any court of law to do so because of our statute of limitations.
Right. And Scott, you did mention, you know, we're not here to bash the Catholic Church, but that really has been our whole thing the whole time. We didn't want anybody to ever feel like this was a vendetta against them. Mm-hmm. We want Catholics, if you decide to stay in the church, to urge your priests, your bishops, your cardinals, your pope, urge them to do the right thing for the victims. And one way to do that is through the statute of limitations. So. Mm-hmm.
A few of you are married and have children. What do you do? What do you think about how to protect your children? And I'm not just talking about the Catholic Church. I'm talking about the mm-hmm. future. I mean, how do you protect them? How do you... I would imagine that... Well, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but that you probably are more protective than others because you've gone through this.
We are very protective.
We are not trusting with anybody, mm-hmm. with our children. I have basically lived my life with my children sheltering them. My children have not slept over anybody's houses. They don't go on play dates. We have been very blessed, most of us, for my mother to help us raise our children and watch our kids when we worked. And my seven-year-old is the very first one that did not get that opportunity with my mom. So I quit working so that I could watch my kid. So it's been tough.
Have you said anything to your children about this?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what did they say?
My son's 17, so I basically just sat him down and said, I just wanted to explain to you what's going on, because he can tell that I'm very emotional. So I had the grand jury video, the report release, and I texted it to him, obviously, because he's 17, after we talked. But I just wanted to let him know that to be open with me if there's anything that he ever needed to talk about, or, you know, just I kind of wanted to let him know why I did not allow him to do the things that he wanted to do, like go to friends' houses, things like that. And he just said, I love you, Mommy. It's okay.
Jennifer, and I want to make sure that we do this before the end of the program. There is a phone number.
Yes.
For, I mean, there may be people listening today who have gone through this experience as well. What is that phone number?
So, and I think this gets back to what we were talking about earlier. So maybe there aren't members of your family that believe you or people in your life that you feel like you can trust, but there is an attorney general and there are some amazing victim advocates in the Commonwealth. And there's an 800 number that's 1-888-538-8541. Those individuals answering that call will believe you and they will advocate and they will fight for you. So I encourage anyone out there to call 1-888-538-8541.
We only have a few minutes left, and again, I want to thank all of you for being with us today. And I know that you have helped some people today, whether they've gone through it, at the very least, understand what it is to go through this. We've talked about the statute of limitations, but what do you want people to know? I mean, you've talked a lot. You've bared your souls here. What do you, if you could leave a message with people listening to this, what would it be?
Well, there's so many people that keep thanking us for what we're doing. And the follow-up question to that is always, what can we do to help? And I think right now the biggest thing to help for victims who are adults, but also for our children and future generations, is to get behind us and just call your senators and urge them to vote for the children and not for the pedophiles, to abolish the statute of limitations and to allow victims who are adults who have, you know, timed out on their statute of limitations the opportunity to
be validated.
Well, there's so many. Be validated. But also to let everybody know who these perpetrators are, because if you don't, if that it doesn't happen, you could be living right next door to a pedophile,
yep,
working right next to him, or they could be taking care of your children in a daycare. Yeah, they're not on Megan's Law.
Doctor, therapist.
I mean, yeah. this is the biggest thing right now. That's how you can help.
It's so much bigger than the church. It's about exposing every single predator who's been able to escape the statute of limitations.
So, yeah. Jennifer, I only have about 30 seconds left. Just so everyone knows, what is the statute of limitations now?
So currently, and it's a very confusing calculation, currently victims have until age 50 to file criminal charges, but that's only if their abuse happened after 2002. You literally need a calculator to determine what your statute of limitations are, because when we've changed them, which have been good moves, it's only applied prospectively to those victims moving forward. So the majority, if not all of the victims in this report and all of our other grand jury reports, have been timed out and will not have access to justice unless they get the window passed.
And all those pedophiles are walking our streets.
Jello died in 1992. Is justice served?
No.
No.
Yeah. No. I want to thank you for being with us today. Laura, Carolyn, Patty, and Teresa Fortney, and Jennifer Storm, Pennsylvania's victim advocate. Again, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, obviously, with all the rain we have had this summer, there's a lot of mold out there. We're going to be talking about some schools that have closed and how the area has been impacted by all the rain. That's coming up on tomorrow's show.